welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, January 20th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, Cedar Rapids Towing Companies Struggle to Catch Up. Backup persists after multiple snow emergencies hit the area. The temperature was close to zero, with a wind chill that made it feel much colder, when Ron Hoxtlert got out of his tow truck Friday to start digging Claudine Nugoshina's car out of the snow along the side of Interstate 380. "It's a nice day out," Hochstetler said. "Well, compared to last night when I was working." Hochstetler Towing, the Cedar Rapids company Hochstetler operates with his grandson, was the third towing company Nugoshina called after she hit a patch of ice and swerved off the road Friday morning while on her way to work. The first two said that they could put her on the waiting list, but they probably wouldn't be able to get to her car until next week. Since last week's snowstorms, which brought blizzard conditions that prompted warnings that travel was not advised throughout much of southern and eastern Iowa, towing companies in Cedar Rapids and around the state have been overwhelmed with the number of people needing services. Between January 8th and January 19th, the Iowa State Patrol responded to almost 3,200 motorist assist calls, or calls, for people who slid off the road or otherwise needed rescue from the storm, according to Sergeant Alex Dinkla, the public information officer for the Iowa State Patrol. Dinkla said he would estimate there are currently thousands of cars left in the ditches on highways across the state waiting to be towed. Tow bans were active in most cities for a few days after the storms, meaning towing companies were already days behind the time that they were able to get on the roads. "I just start at 6 in the morning and end about midnight every night or later," Hoxtetler said. "I'm not even counting calls. I take as many as I can. I get the people done. I'm pretty much staying on the west side of Cedar Rapids right now. That's where my shop is, because there's so much towing going on. If I stay in one area, I can do almost twice as many calls." Hoxtetler Towing has two tow trucks, but he knows a lot of other towing companies in town, so he'll often refer people to other companies he trusts when he's not able to take a call, Hoxtetler said. "But everyone is just as busy. Kevin Ruth, who owns Fast Tow in Cedar Rapids, has stopped taking on new jobs until he's able to finish the ones already on his list. When we're not overwhelmed, we like to give a 60-minute ETA at most. Right now, it's at least a few hours, or the next day, if we're lucky," he said. Kevin's wife, Stephanie Ruth, does the bookkeeping and office work for the business, while Kevin handles the towing with some part-time help from his brother. Stephanie said that the calls have been non-stop since the roads opened up last week. Fast Tow is able to complete about 10 to 20 towing jobs each day, but they're getting more than 100 calls daily. "I answer one and I miss three because we don't have the fancy phone system where you can put 10 people on hold. We run our business with cell phones. It's hard to keep up with the phone calls," Stephanie said. There's a subheader, subsection, says towing large vehicles. Larger businesses such as Tegler, Wrecker, and Crane have also been busy, responding not only to personal vehicles stuck across the state, but also to larger emergencies. Tegler has shops around eastern Iowa and has the equipment and training to tow small personal vehicles as well as larger vehicles such as semi-trucks. Jake Schrader, the operations manager at Tegler, said for the first few days after the tow bans lifted, the company was almost exclusively responding to emergency situations such as semis blocking major roadways or plows that had gotten stuck. "Our list is so long right now of people wanting and needing services. We're doing everything we can to keep up. Emergency stuff is definitely slowing down, and now we're in cleanup mode," Schroeder said. We are well into some 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 hour ETAs, but we're prioritizing jobs based on if they're blocking shoulders and if we're able to work. Semi-trucks that go off the road but aren't in the way of traffic usually won't be removed until nighttime, so lanes don't have to be closed during peak traffic hours. That wait can mean spoiled cargo for trucking companies and long hours for towing staff. So not only is the towing staff working all day, now we've got to go out at night and take these trucks out," Schrader said. "Right now we're dealing with a load of beef that was involved in an accident. He went into a ditch, and then another motorist came by, lost control, hit the back, breaking open the back of the trailer. That particular cargo will not be put in the market due to safety concerns. The final subsection of the article is how to avoid getting stuck. The majority of tow jobs in Eastern Iowa companies have been responding to are for vehicles that got stuck in the snow, either because if the driver lost control and slid off the road, or because the car was parked in a street side or alley that hasn't been plowed. It's also not uncommon for mechanical problems to be exacerbated by the cold weather. Hochstetler said he's responded to a lot of calls for dead batteries and other mechanical failures, because when your car's on a highway, on a halfway margin where everything works in fairly decent weather, then you get this cold spell, that's when your battery says, "I don't want to work." Kevin Ruth agrees. He says the best way to avoid getting stuck out in the cold is to have good tires and a good battery. Slow down when the roads are bad. That would save so many people. If you do get stuck, towing experts recommend calling one company and getting on a waiting list and waiting patiently for availability. The whole entire towing community across Iowa is urging everyone to just be patient with us. We're going to do everything we can and get you taken care of as quickly as we can. We appreciate all of our good customers. We appreciate the opportunity to work for you. Just hold tight with us, Schrader said. Now on to a very different article, but something very interesting. Japan becomes fifth country to land craft on the moon. Japan became the fifth country in history to reach the moon when one of its spacecrafts without astronauts successfully made a soft landing on the lunar surface earlier today. However, space officials said that they need more time to analyze whether the smart lander for investigating moon, or SLIM, achieved its mission priority of making a pinpoint landing. They also said the craft's solar panel had failed to generate power, which could shorten its activity on the moon. Space officials believed the SLIM's small rovers were launched as planned, and the data was being transmitted back to Earth, said Hitoshi Kunaka, head of the Institute of Space and Aeronautical Science, a unit of Japan's space agency. But he said that the SLIM's solar battery wasn't generating power, and that it had only a few more hours of battery life. He said that the priority was now for the craft to gather as much data about its landing and the moon as possible on the remaining battery. Japan follows the United States, the Soviet Union, China, and India in reaching the moon. Kunaka said that he believes that Japan's space program had at least achieved minimum success. SLIM landed on the moon at about 12:20 a.m. Tokyo time today. There was a tense wait for news after Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency Mission Control initially said that SLIM was on the lunar surface, but that yet it still was checking its status. No further details were given until a news conference nearly 2 hours later. For the mission to be considered fully successful, space officials need to confirm whether SLIM made a pinpoint landing. Kunaka said that while more time is needed, he personally thinks it was most likely achieved, based on his observation of data showing the spacecraft's movement until the landing and its ability to transmit signals after landing. SLIM, which was aiming to hit a very small target, is a lightweight spacecraft about the size of a passenger vehicle. It was using pinpoint landing technology that promises far greater control than any previous moon landing. While most previous probes have used landing zones about 6 miles wide, SLIM was aiming at a target of just 330 feet. A landing of such precision would be the world's first, and it would be crucial technology for a sustainable, long-term, and accurate space probe system, said Hiroshi Yamakawa, president of Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, or JAXA. Japan needs technology to secure its place and contribute in international space projects, Yamakawa said. The project was the fruit of 2 decades of work on precision technology by JAXA. SLIM, nicknamed the Moon Sniper, started its descent at midnight today, and within 15 minutes, it was down to about 6 miles above the lunar surface, according to the space agency, which is known as JAXA. At an altitude of 3 miles, the lander was in a vertical descent mode, and then at 165 feet above the surface, Slim was supposed to make a parallel movement to find a safe landing spot, JAXA said. The spacecraft was testing technology to allow moon missions to land where we want to rather than where it is easy to land, JAXA has said. The spacecraft also was supposed to seek clues about the origin of the moon, including analyzing minerals with a special camera. The Slim, equipped with a pad each of its 5 legs to cushion impact, was aiming to land near the Scioli crater, near a region covered in volcanic rock. The closely watched moon mission came only 10 days after a moon mission by the U.S. private company failed when the spacecraft developed fuel leaks hours after the launch. SLIM was launched on a Mitsubishi Heavy H-24 rocket in September. It initially orbited Earth and then entered a lunar orbit on December 25th. Japan hopes to regain confidence for its space technology after a number of failures. A spacecraft designed by a Japanese company crashed during a lunar landing attempt in April, and a new flagship rocket failed its debut launch in March. JAXA has a track record with difficult landings. Its Hayabusa 2 spacecraft, launched in 2014, touched down twice on the 3,000-foot-long asteroid Ryugu, collecting samples that were returned to Earth. SLIM was carrying 2 small autonomous probes, lunar excursion vehicles, LEV-1 and LEV-2, which officials say were believed to have been released just before landing. LEV-1, equipped with an antenna and a camera, is tasked with recording SLIM's landing, and LEV-2 is a ball-shaped rover equipped with 2 cameras, developed by JAXA together with Sony, toy maker Tomy, and Doshiya University. Now, let's go back to a more Iowa-centric article with the article, Reynolds, Iowa Doesn't Need 9 Area Education Agencies. Administrators pay average more than $300K, she says. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said Friday that she does not believe the state needs all of its 9 Area Education Agencies that provide support and expertise to schools, which she has proposed overhauling, while insists she isn't calling for their closures. Reynolds' proposal would redesign AEA's funding structure, streamline the services they offer, and create new oversight in the Iowa Department of Education. She has said that her proposal is needed to update a 50-year-old system and improve special education services and outcomes for students with disabilities by narrowing the focus of AEA's work. The education agencies have strayed beyond their original charge of supporting special education services, she said, and have become too top-heavy. When asked Friday during a recording of her appearance on this weekend's episode of Iowa Press on Iowa PBS, whether Iowa needs 9 AEAs, Reynolds said no. We're a small state, she said. That's why I did the realignment bill with the state government. I need local governments to take a look at the level of bureaucracy that we have in place to serve the citizens of Iowa. It's too much. We need to drive consistency. We need to get that funding in the classroom and do everything we can to improve the outcomes for these children. Reynolds' office has insisted that the governor is not calling for the closure of any AEAs and that her legislative proposal likewise does not require any to close. However, Reynolds has noted that there already has been consolidation in the system. There used to be 15 AEAs in Iowa, and now there are 9, and her plan gives school districts the options to use funding for special education expertise elsewhere. We need to do something big. We need to reform, and I think by giving the districts the ability to hold the AEAs accountable, to decide what program works best for the students they are serving, Reynolds said on Iowa Press. Reynolds' proposal would restructure the way agencies are funded, instead of state and federal funding going to AEAs to fund the services they provide. Reynolds says that Iowa is the only state that operates that way, that the money would instead go to K-12 public school districts, which would determine whether to use that funding for those AEA services or find similar services elsewhere, either at a different AEA or through a private company. Reynolds' proposal also would create an oversight apparatus in the State Education Department. The AEAs are now overseen by locally appointed boards. As justification for her proposal to overhaul and refocus Iowa's AEAs, Reynolds has cited statistics showing Iowa's fourth grade students with disabilities perform below the national average, and fourth and eighth graders and students with disabilities rank 30th or lower on national reading and math assessments. That's unconscionable, Reynolds said. Reynolds this week announced some changes to her initial proposal, which she unveiled January 10th, the day after highlighting it during the annual condition of the state address. The amendment to make those changes, which would loosen the types of services AEA could be allowed to offer beyond special education, has yet to be filed with the rest of the bill. Reynolds has taken the unusual step of issuing public statements on consecutive days this week to update Iowans about the legislative process of her proposal. In those public updates, Reynolds said that she has received feedback about her proposal from parents, teachers, superintendents, and state lawmakers. Really, what we're doing is a kind of eliminating or reducing some of the overhead, Reynolds said on the Iowa PBS show. Right now, we have 9 AEA districts, 9 chiefs, and they are making an average, and they were making on average, when you look at their total compensation package, about $300,100 each, and we don't need 9. We're a small state. The AEAs have varying degrees of what we're offering. We want to simplify it, but that money will go back into the system and into the classroom. Reynolds' proposed legislation was introduced in the Iowa House. The bill, House Study Bill 542, as of Friday, has not yet been scheduled for a legislative hearing, the first step in the state lawmaking process. Iowa Press airs next on Iowa PBS at noon Sunday and can be viewed online at iowapbs.org. Now let's move on to the article. State GOP Chair, caucus turnout shows Iowans care. National news organizations that called the winner of the 2024 Iowa Republican presidential precinct caucuses did not violate any journalistic ethics, Republican Party of Iowa Chairman Jeff Kaufman concedes. But they violated the spirit of the caucuses themselves, he asserts. In an interview Friday with the Gazette, Kaufman discussed the third caucus cycle of his tenure as the state party chairman and how the caucuses ran on Monday night with what the results mean for the future caucuses and whether low turnout will hurt Iowa Republicans' first in the nation status and those quick caucus night calls by national news organizations. Former President Donald Trump won the first in the nation caucuses in historic fashion, becoming the first non-incumbent Republican candidate to surpass 50% support and by beating the field by more than 30 percentage points. Trump won 51% of the votes by cast by 110,000 Iowa Republican caucus goers, while Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was a distant second at 21%, and former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley was third at 19%. The Associated Press, CNN, Fox News, NBC News, and other national news organizations called the caucuses for Trump at roughly 7:30 p.m. Iowa time, Monday, only half an hour after the caucuses started, and Kaufman said before some precincts had completed their presidential preference process, and even while some people still were standing in line to get into their precincts. Kaufman said that he understands those news organizations may have been competing to be among the first to call the caucus winner. But that quick call upset Kaufman because it came before some Iowans had made their choice in the caucuses, a choice that can be swayed at the precinct level by those speaking on behalf of their candidate. We're not dealing with any issue other than that they want to beat each other in the game, and I get that. I understand the rush, Kaufman said. But they all know the spirit of the caucus. They all know that the difference between a caucus and a primary is that in the caucus, you have a conversation ahead of time, that people are undecided and can come on in and hear one more time. To call the race that early when we have people still in line, did it change anything? No, it didn't. But did it break any ethical rules of journalism? No, they didn't. But they also wouldn't have been breaking any ethical rules of journalists if they had respected the nature of the caucus and held off reporting the results so soon. National news organizations use extensive data to gather methods to enable them to project election winners before the official results are fully tabulated. During elections, those organizations do not declare a winner until after the polls are called to avoid influencing voters before they have cast a ballot. The Iowa caucuses, however, do not have an exact time at which the presidential process is complete, creating a gray area for when news organizations can feel comfortable to project a winner. Kaufman said 7:30 was too early. He said the news organizations should have waited until more of the results were officially reported, saying that only 400 precincts of the more than 1,600 statewide had been officially reported when the call was made. I don't know when, I can't give an exact time, because all of those caucuses are run locally, but I can tell you that doing it as fast as they did, with 400 reporting, is not in the spirit of our caucus, Kaufman said. Here's a subheader, caucus turnout. There were 110,298 votes cast by Iowa Republicans in Monday night's caucuses. That is a turnout of 15% of registered Iowa Republican voters, including those who were registered but did not vote in 2022, according to state voter registration data. That turnout is down compared to the record-setting total of nearly 187,000 votes cast in 2016, and also fewer than 2008, roughly 119,000, in 2012, roughly 121,000. Kaufman said Monday night's turnout should be taken as a sign of Iowa Republicans' dedication to the caucuses, given the frigid temperatures that evening, wind chills were in the range of 30 degrees below zero, and the fact that Trump was such a heavy favorite in the caucuses. If you really want to look at this objectively and put it on a bar graph, you will see that 2016 is an anomaly, Kaufman said. But you know what? If they want to try and make that the case, they're going to have to make that call and somehow explain to 110,000 human beings going out with negative 30 wind chill in an election where the polls have consistently said that the winner has this in the bag. There's no way to frame that fact and in and of itself in any other way than Iowans truly care about this. Final subheader is Remaining First. Kaufman said that he believes intimate retail politics and grassroots campaign organizations remain critical to the success in Iowa's caucuses, despite Trump's parachute style of campaigning in Iowa this cycle and in 2016, when he finished a close second to Texas U.S. Senator Ted Cruz. Kaufman said while Trump may have campaigned in Iowa far less often than other candidates and focused on big rallies over shaking hands and answering questions in Pizza Ranch restaurants, he believes that style of campaigning and organizing will remain crucial in future caucuses. And Kaufman said that he believes Iowa Republicans will retain their envied leadoff position in the nation and presidential nominating process. He said that he believes Iowa will be able to convince national party leaders that the state deserves to remain first. And Kaufman said that he genuinely hopes that Iowa Democrats are able to recoup their first-in-the-nation status, which was removed this cycle when National Democratic Party leaders changed their party's nominating calendar. I just think that all the criticism that we've heard throughout the years, I really think Monday night dispels a lot of them, Kaufman said, and hopefully, who knows, maybe in 2028 there will be both parties out here. Now onto a brief health article. Beware of respiratory illness infiltrating the state. Iowa health officials document high COVID-19 activity and moderate influenza activity. Respiratory illnesses are swirling around Iowa based on state data. Healthcare professionals are urging residents to keep themselves and others safe. In its latest respiratory virus surveillance report issued this month, the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services documented high COVID-19 activity and moderate influenza activity. Of the 4,229 COVID-19 lab tests administered from New Year's Eve to January 6th, about 17% came back positive. That's down from about 20% the week before, but up from the 11% at this time last year. About 5% of Iowa's emergency room visits from the first week of 2024 were due to COVID-19, and there were 329 hospitalizations. 9 COVID-19 deaths were reported. About 16% of the 4,207 influenza lab tests performed in that time frame came back positive, down from the 17% the week before, but up from the 13.5% at this time last year. 5 flu outbreaks in Iowa long-term care facilities were reported. There were 78 hospitalizations due to the flu and 2 deaths at this time last year, and there were 202 flu-related hospitalizations and 20 deaths. RSV cases are on the rise. The percentage of lab tests coming back positive for respiratory virus increased from 13.8% at the end of 2023 to 14.6% by the first week of 2024. In the first week of January, schools reported illness-related absences for about 3% of the state's enrolled students. One school in southeast Iowa reported 10% or more of its enrollment was absent due to illness. The Eastern Iowa Health Center, Linn County Public Health, Mercy Medical Center, and Unity Point Health Cedar Rapids all encourage residents to get vaccinated against respiratory illnesses. You can help prevent the spread of illnesses by covering your coughs and sneezes, cleaning your hands frequently, and staying home when you feel sick. COVID-19 and influenza vaccines are widely available at your local healthcare provider, offices, pharmacies, and Linn County Public Health. You can find a vaccination location near you at vaccines.gov. Now let's go on to the article. Childress told police how man was killed, denied being shooter. Childress identified another man who he also is accused of killing the next day. A police investigator testified Friday that Kazius Childress admitted to being at the house where 19-year-old Cordell Lewis was fatally shot in January 2022, but Childress identified the shooter as another man who he also is accused of killing one day later. Cedar Rapids police investigator Sarah Lacina and Kazius Childress, 22, initially denied being at 309 31st Street Drive Southeast on January 27, 2022, when Lewis was shot outside the home as he was running away from the shooter. Childress said that he and Lewis were friends, but he hadn't seen him in a while since a week before his death. Childress also denied more than once that ever being at the home, Lacina said. Pierre Baugh, 34, and her girlfriend, Quinalia Jones, 24, also charged in Lewis's fatal shooting, told police Childress was there that day, but he continued to deny it, the investigator said. When Lacina said that they had a video of him at a gas station with the two women before the fatal shooting, Childress then recalled that and eventually admitted to being at the 31st Street Drive Southeast, where Baugh was living at the time. Childress is charged with first-degree murder and going armed with intent. His trial started Tuesday, and the prosecution is expected to wrap up its case Monday. According to testimony Wednesday, Lewis was running away from Childress, who fired 11 times, striking Lewis multiple times in the back. Bullets hit Lewis's sternum and went through his heart. Lewis was found dead at the 300 block of 31st Street Drive Southeast. Childress, after others had robbed Lewis of money and some jewelry. Childress told Lacina that he was with Kevon Johnson, who he is accused of fatally shooting January 28, 2022, when Baugh and Jones picked him up in a tan Chevrolet Impala to go to Jones' house, but instead went to 309 31st Street Drive Southeast. Johnson went with two other women in a SUV and they picked up Lewis. The women didn't come into the house. At some point, Childress said Johnson asked to see Lewis's gun and he gave the 9mm to Johnson. Johnson then robbed Lewis and told him to empty his pockets for money and took the chain necklaces Lewis was wearing. Childress, who they were told repeatedly to get out by the homeowner, Clee Barney, who testified in the trial. Lacina said that when they went outside, Childress said Johnson and Lewis walked out to the grass near the driveway, and he and Baugh were on the front steps. Childress said Johnson then shot Lewis, and he continued to shoot as Lewis ran away. Childress said that he saw Lewis fall to the ground, so he tried to get in the house, but Barney wouldn't let him. So he got in the Impala with Baugh and Jones. Johnson got in the SUV. Childress told Lacina that before they drove off, Baugh took the gun from Johnson and put it in a bag of dog food in the house. According to testimony, the gun was found in a box in the basement. After Jones drove off, Childress said that he made her go back because he wanted to check on Lewis. He got out, but Jones was yelling at Childress to get back in the car or he would be left. He got back in and they went to Jones's home. The Linn County attorney, Nick Maybanks, asked Lacina if Childress said Lewis was making threats to Johnson, or if Johnson shot Lewis because Lewis was trying to kill him. The defense, in its opening, said Lewis was the one being aggressive. Lacina said no. Attorney Adrian Houghton, who representing Childress, asked if the Childress seemed fearful. Lacina said no. Houghton then asked if it was more likely if somebody was involved in a murder, they may not be forthcoming. Lacina said it depends on their role in the incident, but if they did something wrong, they usually don't tell the truth. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, January 20th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We're going to finish up this article and then we'll move on to today's obituaries. We've got a subheader in the article that we were last reading. The subheader is, "Shell castings from the scene may have come from one gun." In other testimony, Victor Murillo, who is now retired but was an Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation criminalist in 2022 and last year, testified about the 9 shell castings found at the scene. The spent castings all had similar markings, meaning that they could have been fired by the same gun, the 9mm found at the scene. He identified 3 of the casings that matched the gun when he viewed them microscopically. They usually don't identify all the casings if they have similar markings. He randomly selected 3. Thaddeus Pizer, Cedar Rapids Police Crime Scene Investigator, testified that there were 2 firearms found at the home, the 9mm pistol in the basement, which he identified as the murder weapon, and another handgun found in Baugh's room lying in a laundry basket. The murder weapon didn't have any fingerprints, which isn't unusual because the surface texture of a grip and even the side aren't suitable for latent prints, Pizer said. To get a good print, the surface has to be smooth. Let's move on to today's obituaries now, starting with Loreen S. Frenzen. Loreen S. Frenzen, age 98, longtime resident of the Iowa City area, died Wednesday, January 17th, 2024, at Mercy Hospital under the very compassionate care of the staff at Mercy and Iowa City Hospice. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, January 22nd, 2024, at St. Mark's United Methodist Church in Iowa City, where there will be a time for visitation from 9 a.m. until services at the church. Burial will follow a reception at the church at Memory Garden Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations can be made in her memory to Iowa City Hospice or Tecumseh High School Sculpture Garden at 760 Brown Street, Tecumseh, Missouri, 49286. Loreen Saloma Dinger was born September 21st, 1925, in Cahokia, Montana, daughter of Henry and Saloma Dinger. She attended schools in Cahokia, graduating from Cahokia High School in 1943. She married Glenn F. Frenzen on March 9th, 1947, in Cahokia. Loreen was the epitome of the stay-at-home mom, raising their 3 children, making sure everyone had what everyone needed, active in the community and church, and still making a home of much love and faith. After Glenn's retirement in 1993, the couple moved to Bass Lake near Knox, Indiana, and eventually moved to Iowa City to be closer to family. She was an active member of St. Mark's United Methodist Church, UMW, and a hard-working member of the Rags to Riches Quilting Club. This club is responsible for making quilts from women's shelter and domestic violence home. Also, this group made numerous lap blankets for residents of Iowa City Care Center. She and Glenn enjoy traveling and camping. Belonging to the Handicapped Travel Club and Good Sam Camping Group. Laureen loved life. She loved her family and friends. Many of these people have been the recipient of her very personal, unique, and simply beautiful greeting cards that she made and sent to others with her notes of love. Her family includes three children, Ron Frenzen, Darnold Frenzen, and Judy Steffen, six grandchildren, Ellen Lower, Abigail Derberry, Janine Goldman, Curry Farrell, Nicole Sullivan, and Jacob Steffen, and 13 great-grandchildren, Carter Kennedy, Taylor, Madison, Colton, Benny, Fallon, Haiti, Reese, Mackie, Jack, Eve, and Hunter, and numerous nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, husband, Glenn, three sisters, Lenora Hunziker, Mary Kemi, and Clarine Drebs, and an infant brother. Garen L. Raines. Garen L. Raines of Solon, Iowa, passed away on December 14, 2023, at age 80 at Valley Baptist Memorial Hospital in Harlington, Texas. Garen was born on April 28, 1943, to parents Brian and Charlotte Meinhardt Raines. Garen worked as a machinist at Terex, formerly Iowa Manufacturing, for 41 years. He enjoyed sports, participating in Golden Age Olympics and Encore Games in Texas. Garen won the Iowa State Horseshoe Championship, two championships in beanbags at Golden Age Olympics, and championship in beanbags and horseshoes at the Encore Games. Garen was a quiet man whose actions spoke for him. Garen retired in 2005, choosing to spend his winters at Sunshine RV Resorts in Harlington, Texas, and his summers on his land in Solon. His beloved dog, Dude, was his constant companion. Garen is survived by his loving wife of 39 years, Ruth Raines, children Gary Raines, Scott Raines, Mark Raines, Lisa Almazan, Leslie Hubbard, Cheryl Daves. Garen has two living siblings, Rhonda Moffat and Cheryl Overman. Garen has 14 grandchildren and 4 great-grandchildren. Garen was also preceded in death by his parents, Brian and Charlotte Raines, and sister Glenna Schnell. Graveside services and celebration of life will be this summer. Online condolences and memorials may be shared with family at www.brochechapel.com. Elise Brammer. On January 15, 2024, Elise Brammer passed away peacefully at the age of 91. An Iowa native, she lived for over 50 years in Anamosa, where she raised her two children with her husband, Jerry. Born in Mount Vernon, she graduated with a BA in Music and Home Economics from Simpson College. After Jerry's retirement from teaching, they traveled the country, visiting historic sites and enjoying theater and various stage shows. She was an avid gardener, and several times over the years boasted a Yard of the Week sign. After the death of her husband of 52 years, she would often spend time with her sister, Opal, before moving to Denver to be closer to her children. Alice was predeceased by Jerry and her son, Dan. She is survived by her daughter, Julie, son-in-law, Jim, and her grandson, Daniel. A graveside service will be held at Cedar Memorial Center in Cedar Rapids on January 25th at 1 p.m. Online condolences may be left online at www.cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. Now let's move on to some sports articles, starting with some NFL. Packers 49ers playoff rivalry full of moments. Kyle Juszczyk remembers the different feel when he took the field for the first time in the playoff rivalry between San Francisco 49ers and the Green Bay Packers. two storied franchises with rich traditions that produced big stars facing off against each other on the playoff stage. The teams are set to meet for the third time in the past five postseasons tonight, when the Packers, who are 10-8, visit the 49ers, who are 12-5, in the divisional round. "It's always fun," Juzevic said. "Green Bay is just such a storied franchise. That rivalry of San Francisco and Green Bay is always a big one. Honestly, one of my best memories as a Niner was that NFC Championship game here against the Packers and just in the warm-ups. Just feeling that energy. It was nothing I've ever felt here before. It was just such an exciting time, and hopefully we feel that again this week." The Niners won that 2020 matchup 37-20 to go to the Super Bowl, and then repeated it 2 years later when they upset the Packers in Green Bay 13-10. Few franchises have been as intertwined over the last three decades as the Packers and 49ers, with coaches getting the draft decision that sent Aaron Rodgers packing for Green Bay instead of staying close to home and receiving the 49ers. The teams that have combined for 9 Super Bowl titles will meet with a spot in the NFC Championship game on the line. This will be the record-setting 10th playoff meeting between the franchises. All of those games have come in the past 29 seasons, with no other teams meeting more than 5 times in the postseason in that span. Here's a look back at the rivalry, starting with a subheader, Changing of Guard. The Niners had been the NFL's dominant franchise with 5 Super Bowl titles in 14 seasons when they ran into the Packers in the divisional round of the 1995 playoffs. Coach Mike Holmgren had left his job as offensive coordinator in San Francisco to take over the Packers in 1992. The man who tutored Steve Young in college and the pros set out to groom the untested Brett Favre, who was acquired in the trade from Atlanta the same year. With Favre and Holmgren at the helm, along with the free agent acquisition of Reggie White, the Packers surpassed the Niners in that meeting at Candlestick Park, January 6, 1996. Adam Walker fumbled on San Francisco's first play from scrimmage, and Craig Newsome returned it for a touchdown. Favre followed with 2 quick touchdown passes as Green Bay rolled to a 27-17 win. The Packers lost the following week against Dallas, but soon established themselves as the NFC's dominant team. The teams met again the following year when Desmond Howard returned a punt 71 yards for a touchdown after San Francisco's opening possession. Young was knocked out later in the first quarter with an injury, and the Packers won 35-14 on the way to a Super Bowl title. There was a time that you could just say, hey, no matter the 49ers are a better team than Green Bay, Packers defensive end Sean Jones said after that game. There was a time when they could make mistakes and still not play their best, and you knew that they were going to win. Well, those days are over. The Packers' dominance in the series led to George Seferitz resigning as coach and former Packers assistant Steve Marucci taking over. Green Bay won its first playoff matchup 23-10 against Marucci the following year as the frustration mounted in San Francisco. Next subheader is the Catch 2. The Niners finally had a breakthrough the following year, thanks to one of the most memorable plays of the series in San Francisco's only playoff win over Favre. On January 3, 1999, Terrell Owens lost a fumble and dropped a potential touchdown pass early before delivering late. With 8 seconds left, the Niners trailing by 4, Young stumbled, dropping back from the center and then threaded a 25-yard pass between a phalanx of Packers to Owens, who somehow managed to hold on to it despite being hit by 2 defenders, for over 30-27 win. Favre won his final playoff meeting against the Niners 3 years later, and the rivalry then took a hiatus. Next subheader is Kaepernick's Rise. The teams didn't meet again in the postseason until the 2012 season when Rodgers got the shot against the Niners team that famously passed him up for Alex Smith in the 2005 draft. Colin Kaepernick had replaced Smith as a starter late that season and established himself as a phenomenon when he ran for a quarterback record 181 yards and 2 scores and threw for 263 yards and 2 touchdowns in a 45-31 San Francisco win. Kaepernick braved the cold of Green Bay the following year and played without long sleeves or gloves. He led a late winning drive that knocked the Packers out again. Final subheader is Shanahan versus LaFleur. There has been a familiarity again during the recent editions of the rivalry, with Niners coach Kyle Shanahan and Packers coach Matt LaFleur having a history together. Shanahan has the upper hand, winning the 2019 NFC title game behind Raheem Mostert's 220-yard rushing and 4 touchdowns to go to the Super Bowl. San Francisco then braved the 15-degree cold in Green Bay 2 years later to upset the top-seeded Packers 13-10 on a blocked punt touchdown that tied the game and a final play 45-yard field goal by Robbie Gould. Let's move on to a more local sports article with some Iowa basketball. Iowa sophomore Dix has had back-to-back career highs in Hawkeyes' third game win streak. Iowa has hopped up the Big Ten's men basketball standings with 3 straight wins, and now is a chance to make a big leap. The Hawkeyes host Purdue today at 1 p.m. The Boilermakers aren't infallible. They lost 92-88 in overtime at Northwestern on December 1st and fell 88-72 at Nebraska on January 9th. But they also own 5 wins over teams that were ranked number 11 or higher at the time, including then number 1 Arizona. Purdue is number 2 itself and had 2 short runs at number 1. It's one of the most efficient offensive teams in the nation. They have veteran guys. They have National Player of the Year center Zach Eddy, and they have multiple 3-point shooters. They have depth. They have competitive guys in every spot, said Iowa coach Fran McCaffrey. You really have to defend every possession to stop them. Purdue's most recent game was an 87-66 blitz in Indiana and Bloomington, with Eddie notching 33 points and 14 rebounds. The Hawkeyes haven't been chopped liver lately themselves. They've averaged 88.7 points in their last 3 games, Big Ten wins of 9 points or more. The latest was a 86-77 triumph at Minnesota on Monday. Someone who has come into the forefront of Iowa recently is guard Josh Dix. The sophomore from Council Bluffs scored a career-high 16 points last Friday in the Hawkeyes' 94-76 win over Nebraska. He topped that with 21 Monday at Minnesota, along with 5 assists and 2 steals. It was almost 2 years ago to the day when Dix landed awkwardly and suffered a broken tibia and broken fibula during Council Bluffs Lincoln's game against Lamar's. The Iowa Comet seemed like a good bet to redshirt his first year at Iowa. My doctor at home told me it probably would take like 10 to 12 months, Dix said, so that would have put me like coming back in December. But once I got here, they kind of sped up the process a little bit. I worked with Brad Floyd, the trainer, and he helped me get back by September. I really thought that we were going to have to redshirt him, McCaffrey said, but he was ready to go, and he was really good for us. We won some games last year because of him. Dix played in 31 games off the bench, with his minutes varying. He had a 10-point, 5-assist performance that was essential for Iowa and a home win over Michigan. This current win streak has looked like a liftoff for Dix's career. He had made 8 of 12 three-pointers and averaged 3.7 assists. He has a lot of nice moments over the last 2 games. One that stood out was a step-back three-pointer at Minnesota, a poised and smooth play. I feel like I just need to be more confident in my game and trust myself a little more and be aggressive on the court, Dix said. He's pretty quiet, McCaffrey said, but he's really locked in. He's really focused. He's a serious guy. He's an intense competitor, but he's also really cerebral. He knows and understands the game, and he knows and understands what the game plan is. He's a great team guy in the sense that it's never about him, but then he ends up impacting the game in a big way. The coach said forward Patrick McCaffrey was 50-50 to return to action from an ankle issue Saturday, so Dix may again be counted on to fill that vacuum. Now let's move on to what may be the final article of today. Some Cyclones basketball. Cyclones aiming to end long-range shooting slump. The subject turned to shooting, and Iowa State freshman Milan Malsavuk is an established expert on the subject. So diagnosing precisely what is causing Cyclones' three-point shooting woes early in the Big 12 play didn't prove difficult, and he started with a self-critique. "I feel like I'm getting pretty good looks, and I'm just missing right now," said Malsavuk, who hopes to help ISU snap out of its long-range shooting funk at 1 p.m. today against TCU in a Big 12 men's basketball game at Fort Worth, Texas. "I think it's just adjusting to Big 12 play right now, but I think I'll be fine moving forward. Call it a blip, an aberration maybe, but don't call the Cyclones' current 21.7% mark from beyond the arc a trend, not until there's a larger sample size than four games to scrutinize at least. Throughout the season, we've gotten a lot of things at the rim, a lot of post-ups, a lot of attacks, picks, and rolls. So I feel like we haven't had to use the three-point shot as much," said Mosavilic, who leads Iowa starters in three-point accuracy at 39.5%. "But now, since it's Big 12 play and everyone's athletic and there are shot blockers at the rim, we're going to need to use that three-point shot as an advantage, as a weapon. So far, it's been a liability." Momsilovic's three-point percentage had dipped to 26.1% against the Big 12 competition. "But that's quite a bit better than most of his teammates who fired up long-range shots with any regularity." Starting guard Kashawn Gilbert is 0-for-8 from beyond the arc in conference play. Backup guard Curtis Jones is 2-for-9, and leading scorer Tamin Lipsey hit just 2 of his 11 three-point tries since league games began. And Lipsey, the only player in the country to average as many as 14.5 points, 5.6 assists, 5.5 rebounds, and 3.4 steals in more than 25 years, might not play against the Horned Frogs because of a sprained shoulder. "I think everybody kind of moves one place forward in terms of opportunity if Lipsey can't play," said Otzelberger, whose team owns a three-game win streak against TCU. "So guys like Kurt Jones and Jackson Palovetsky and Damarian Watson have more opportunities with those guards' minutes, maybe they'll get on a normal night." There's no such thing as normal in the Big 12, however. Particularly on the road, when teams are a combined 8-20, the Cyclones are one of six Big 12 teams to be winless on the road, and that's a situation they must change if they hope to contend for a top-tier finish in the league standings. "The physical play every single night is impactful," Otzelberger said, of a 14-team conference that currently features 8 teams in the Associated Press Top 25. "So what happens is I feel like defensively at home, you're able to impose your will more, and that pushes other teams' offense and makes the degree of difficulty a lot of times with the shots harder. I think that what you see is the teams on the roads oftentimes take a more mid-range shots because they're not able to get all the way to the rim, or shots are being taken away at the three-point line. I think you're seeing that across the board, that the home teams certainly have that advantage and that confidence and their fan base and the crowd behind them. One thing Mosilovic doesn't lack is confidence, even with his recent shooting struggles away from home. Nothing really changes," he said. "Even though there are a lot of fans rooting against you, just do what we do every day." We have just a little bit of time left, so we'll read a national note. The title of "More Join NCAA Transfer Rules Suit." The Department of Justice, three more states, and the District of Columbia have joined a lawsuit against the NCAA's transfer eligibility rule. The federal agency signed on to the action, saying its announcement this week that the NCAA's rule on transfers is an illegal restraint on college athletes' ability to sell their image and likeness and control their education. The Department of Justice said attorney generals from the state of Minnesota, Mississippi, Virginia, and the District of Columbia also signed on to the suit. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, January 20th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.